political headlines this hour. Finland and Sweden are now one step closer to joining NATO, with all 30 members of the alliance signing their accession protocol. For the first time in three decades, Germany registers a rare deficit in its monthly trade. Also ahead, Mexico's president calls for a campaign to dismantle the Statue of Liberty if Julian Assange is extradited to the U.S. and convicted. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. NATO's 30 members sign an accession protocol for Finland and Sweden, taking a further step towards letting the Nordic states into the military alliance. Under the protocol, both countries can take part in the alliance's meetings and have more access to intelligence. But NATO will not defend them militarily until their membership is ratified. Speaking at a presser afterwards, the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg hailed the signing of the protocol as a historic moment and said that the alliance will be stronger and safer with its new members. The two countries requested to join NATO after Russia launched its military operation in Ukraine in February. Russia has repeatedly announced its opposition to NATO's enlargement. Last week, President Vladimir Putin said it is inevitable that Moscow's relations with Helsinki and Stockholm will sour once they join the U.S.-led alliance. Our Brussels correspondent Jerome Hughes tells us more about the significance of Finland and Sweden joining NATO, and also how future political transitions could affect the process.
Well, you know, it could take much longer than a year, in fact. And don't forget, in the meantime, you have political transitions. So you could have a change of government in the current 30 members of NATO. And so obviously the landscape could change in terms of opposition to this move. But I mean, just once again, to quote, if you Pope Francis, for example, just to quote him, because he's seen as a moderate figure, he says that this conflict in Ukraine, it was provoked or it could have been prevented. And what you see is the expansion of NATO at all costs. You see an endless amount of money going into NATO. Don't forget, most of the countries that are in the EU are NATO members. The EU at the same time in parallel is forming its own army. So you have billions of euro going into a new EU army. At the same time, you had Donald Trump pushing for a minimum of 2% of GDP for NATO members to spend on military hardware. And you've got the likes of the UK now saying that they'll spend 2.5%. So you have this endless amount of money going into NATO. And this endless, as people would say it, if you listen to many analysts, they say this endless provocation of against Russia. There's just this build-up of NATO forces right along Russia's borders. And, you know, one of the red lines for Vladimir Putin was for Ukraine not to join NATO. It looks like that's not going to happen, of course, but it looks like Ukraine is going to join the EU. The EU will have a new army soon. And they're already spending a fortune on that. So de facto, you know, Ukraine will be part of a major military force. And so really the end game here and the big question when you listen to analysts, when you speak to political scientists, when you speak to security experts, they're asking the question, where is this all going to end? At what point are we going to see World War III? Really, that's what people are saying.
Germany posts a monthly trade deficit for the first time in three decades, as the war in Ukraine takes its toll on European economies. The German Federal Statistics Office says imports exceeded exports by roughly $1 billion in May compared with April. The rare deficit is blamed on interrupted supply chains and record energy prices. This is partially triggered by Russia's move to cut back on natural gas supply to Europe. Germany relies on Russia for 35% of its natural gas needs. Germany's Federation of Trade Unions has warned that the short supply can lead to the collapse of entire industries if it remains unresolved. Shelling by Ukrainian forces has killed at least two people in the eastern Donetsk region, which is now the new epicenter of the war between Kiev and Moscow. According to pro-Russia forces, five civilians were killed and 13 others wounded in Ukrainian shelling of the region one day earlier. Local officials accused Russian forces of launching similar deadly attacks on civilians. The governor of Donetsk says seven civilians were killed and at least 20 others injured as a result of Russian shelling on Sunday. Russian forces captured the neighboring Luhansk region over the weekend, marking a significant milestone for Moscow. President Putin hailed what he described as the liberation of the region, ordering his forces to continue advancing towards the western parts of Donetsk. Ukrainian forces are boosting their defenses in the region. Pro-Russia forces in Ukraine controlled large parts of the Luhansk and Donetsk, which formed Donbass before the war broke out. Our correspondent in Donetsk, Johnny Miller, tells us about the latest developments in eastern Ukraine after Russian forces fully captured Luhansk.
Well, here in Donetsk, there was about a week in which there was no Ukrainian bombing of this city. We expected that the reasons for that are Russian counter-strikes on the artillery positions just on the outskirts of the city. But a few days ago, shelling of Donetsk began again. As you like to say, there's been many casualties. Yesterday, a market was hit near the railway station. One person was confirmed killed there. And already this morning, I can hear some incoming in the city. So Ukraine, since the beginning of Russia's invasion, indeed, intermittently over the last 8 years, has been shelling civilians here in Donetsk, trying to terrorize the population effectively and trying to inhibit their support of the pro-Russian forces here. So unless Russia mounts some more counter-strikes against those artillery positions, we can expect the killing of civilians here to go on for the coming days. It's also important to remember that NATO, of course, is arming now the Ukrainian army, who are intentionally shelling these civilians. Now, further north, of course, where we have the main fighting, the Russian army is advancing there. They've taken Lysychansk. We're not sure yet whether the Ukrainian forces will try and set up defensive positions in the town of Sversk, or whether they will try to retreat further to the more defendable cities of Kramatorsk and Slavyansk. Meanwhile, Russia is carrying out major strikes around those towns in order to soften up defenses. But Russia is able to make large advances recently after taking Lysychansk.
Mexico's president says the Statue of Liberty would no longer be a symbol of freedom and should be dismantled if the U.S. gives a death sentence to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. López Obrador, who has offered asylum to Assange, says that he would call on the U.S. president to drop the charges against him. Obrador added that the Australian whistleblower has been treated unfairly and worse than a criminal. Assange is facing extradition from Britain to the U.S., where he is charged with publishing classified military and diplomatic documents. The WikiLeaks founder has appealed the British court ruling on his extradition. Tehran has held the fourth International Conference on American Human Rights. The event reviewed the human rights situation worldwide and its challenges as a result of the U.S. policies. A senior Iranian official told the meeting the U.S. is in no position to talk about human rights. Our Tehran correspondent Saman Khajuri reports.
Tehran has organized a fourth edition of its International Conference on American Human Rights. The conference was attended by Iranian officials, experts, and the youth from over 50 countries. The event was held on the occasion of the American Human Rights Week in Iran. It reviewed the human rights situation worldwide and its challenges as a result of the United States' double standard policies. Addressing the event, Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, Kazem Gharibabadi, said the U.S. is in no position to talk about human rights, given its widespread violations.
One can confidently claim that there is no nation in today's world that has not tasted the bitter taste of the American version of human rights. The U.S. administration should be held responsible to the oppressed peoples who have lost their lives as a result of terrorism, sanctions, aggression, and occupation.
Iranian officials and experts believe that the gravest violation that can be committed against human rights is to politicize the issue, and this is exactly what the U.S. has done. A senior Iranian diplomat says human rights are turned into a pretext and a tool for the expansion and institutionalization of the predominance of American unilateralism.
Today, human rights are turned into a pretext and a tool for expansion and institutionalization of the predominance of American unilateralism. Sanctions and terrorism are the main pillars of the American version of human rights. If they are robbed of these two pillars, they may not be able to continue their dominance and plots.
Analysts believe that the unilateral U.S. sanctions are a means of collective punishment of all people, without any exception. Here in Iran, people believe that the title American Human Rights Week seeks to condemn Washington's double standard policies with regard to human rights and reveal this very reality to the world. Saman Khajuri,
Tehran.
Iran says it is ready to once again engage constructively in the talks for the revival of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action to achieve an agreement. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says that Tehran backs a strong and lasting agreement. Amir Abdollahian says, however, that this would hinge on the U.S. showing initiative and flexibility. He made the comments in a phone call with his Omani counterpart, Badr al-Busaidi. The Omani official says that his country supports the realization of the legitimate demands of Iran in the talks. Iran and the U.S. held indirect talks in the Qatari capital, Doha, last week. Tehran says the main hurdle to an agreement in the discussions remains the U.S. committing itself to its obligations under the JCPOA. The U.S. State Department says that Israeli military gunfire was likely responsible for the killing of veteran Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh in May. The department, however, says it has found no reason to believe that the shooting was intentional. It also claims that investigators could not reach a definitive conclusion regarding the origin of the bullet that killed the journalist. The department says the bullet was badly damaged, and that prevented a clear conclusion. A member of the Palestine Liberation Organization has accused Washington of trying to protect Tel Aviv. On Saturday, the Palestinian Authority agreed to transfer the Americans the bullet that killed the Al Jazeera reporter for examination. However, one day later, an Israeli military spokesman said that Israel would conduct the test under American observation. Abu Akleh was killed on May 11 while covering an Israeli army raid in the city of Jenin. Last month, UN Human Rights Office confirmed that it was Israeli fire that killed her. Gaza-based political activist Moti Abu Musabeh says the U.S. support for Israel and the killing of the Al Jazeera journalist will embolden the regime in its crimes against Palestinians.
Actually, it has become a matter of fact the result of this investigation presents another clue and blatant evidence on the blind support of the U.S. administration for the Israeli occupation, and gives the Israeli occupation the green light to commit more and more crimes against the Palestinian people. And we all realize that this was not the first crime Israel commits against the Palestinian journalist, and it would never be the last as long as the U.S. administration covers the Israeli occupation and backs the Israeli occupation forces. According to Al Jazeera report, more than 45 Palestinian journalists was killed by the Israeli occupation forces since 2000 so far. So this should mean that Israel tends to deliberately target the Palestinian journalist, and it's stemming from the constant policy that Israel uses against the Palestinian people and the Palestinian journalists precisely in order to cover its crimes. Israel tends to target the Palestinian journalists in order to hide its crimes and violations committed on a recurring matter against the Palestinian people, because Israel is always afraid of telling the truth. As this goes against the Israeli and the Zionist propaganda that promotes the Israeli occupation and the Israeli state as a democratic state and a vibrant democratic state in the Middle East.
Russia has slammed as unacceptable the recent strikes in Syria that have been blamed on Israel, calling for an unconditional cessation of the attacks. The Russian Foreign Ministry has strongly condemned the attacks as irresponsible actions that violate Syria's sovereignty. Moscow says such aggressions also constitute a breach of international law. On the 2nd of July, Israel carried out fresh airstrikes on the Arab country. Damascus said Israel fired several missiles from the Mediterranean west of the Lebanese city of Tripoli, targeting Syria's port city of Tartus. According to Syrian officials, at least two civilians were injured in the attack. The strike also caused some material damage. That was the latest in a spate of Israeli strikes against Syria. Damascus has time and again denounced Israeli acts of aggression and has filed official complaints with the UN and other international bodies. British Muslims have gathered to condemn New Delhi's failures to stop extremist mobs attacking and harassing Muslims across India. Protesters also criticized the Indian government for its other Islamophobic policies. Rob Carter reports.
British Indians flocked to central London Sunday to condemn India's ruling government over its failures to protect Indian minorities from persecution. The anger comes after a string of incidents saw huge numbers of India's 204 million Muslims turn against the authorities, which Muslims claim are systematically discriminating against them.
Violence and discriminatory rhetoric against minorities in India has become so commonplace that many onlookers fear that a genocide may be on the horizon. Muslims in particular are fearful, given that Islamophobic hate crimes have run rampant in India.
Accusations against New Delhi include allowing sectarian attacks on mosques, failing to stop anti-Muslim lynch mobs, hijab bans, and the bulldozing of homes in Muslim areas, essentially a type of ethnic cleansing.
What's happened to minorities in India, if you don't know, is it is on the brink of genocide. This peaceful demonstration is not against India. I want to repeat, it's not against India, it's against the government of India. They are not doing anything, they are complacent. They are basically wanting to make India into a Hindu Rashtra and move away from democracy.
I think that it's wrong that there should be hijab bans. It's wrong that people should be persecuted for interfaith relationships. It's wrong that Indian Muslim homes are bulldozed. And it's wrong, as we saw with Indian farmers, that the state sanctioned sedition and suppression of rights and views and peaceful protests.
India's Prime Minister, who heads the ruling BJP party, has been accused of pushing an extremist Hindu nationalism, which preaches intolerance of other religious groups. Under Narendra Modi's watch, India has been routinely condemned by human rights groups over anti-Muslim discrimination, but the attention of Western leaders has been more focused on building trade with India to help combat economic instability. And that is why, so far, concerns by Muslims in India have fallen mostly on deaf ears. Robert Carter, London.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with the concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Imam presented a new model for the Islamic Republic, which was completely different from those two systems. Liberal democracy, which is based on capital, and communism, which is based on dictatorship. In Imam's model, certain dualisms became coordinated and harmonious. The dualism that were previously attempted to be set against one another were brought together and harmonized. Imam put them next to one another. One of these dualisms was the execution of divine rules alongside observance of public expediency and interest. It was Imam who formed the Expediency Council. Some people think that it was I who established it. At that time, I was president. Imam wrote me a letter and held a meeting to establish the Expediency Council. Islamic rules were enforced, but the expediencies of the time and public interest were observed as well. This is what is meant by expediency. It does not mean showing certain consideration for individuals. Another dualism was attempting to the needy and insisting on economic justice, in particular economic justice, as well as generating wealth. Both the generation of wealth and justice in the case of poor must definitely be observed in Imam's viewpoints.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another dualism was the rejection of both oppression and accepting oppression. As a political system, government and nation, we will not oppress other governments and nations, and we will not accept the oppression either. We will not bully others, nor do we surrender to bullying. We will both strengthen science and economy and the defensive mechanism of the country. It was not the case that we only think of the economy and ignore the country's defensive mechanism and security. The opposite is true as well. Both national solidarity and unity and diversity and the existence of various political orientations must be officially accepted. This is another dualism. Officials should have both piety and purity and expertise and competence. How did he want to make this future distinct?
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Racist policies are enshrined in Israeli law, however, one specifically denies 6 million Palestinians the right to return to the territory from which they were expelled only a few decades ago. The same law, however, permits Jews across the world to settle in any part of Palestine. Such practices, including the racial fragmentation of Palestine into zones of control, where half of the population enjoys full rights of citizenship denied to the non-Jewish half, have led most human rights groups and advocates to label Israel as an apartheid state. Meanwhile, Israel continuously and explicitly rejects international consensus and seems to have found strong support for their radical position from the Texas Republican Party in foreclosing any chance of a Palestinian state from ever being established.
Violence and instability are perhaps a good thing because violence implies that there will be resistance to this land grab and this denial of Palestinian rights. And as far as I'm concerned, the more resistance, the better. And Palestine needs to do resistance, and it needs its friends and allies to participate in resistance. I know that the policy of Iran and Syria and some other nations is to support Palestine in this kind of resistance. And in fact, it is now going in the direction that the entire world is saying, well, we're not going to listen to the United States anymore and NATO, for example, because the United States has now declared sanctions against so many countries that the those countries are unifying amongst themselves to defy the United States. So we may be entering a new period when, unfortunately, violence, but resistance, and most likely violent resistance, is the only answer to the warmongers.
Though party platforms do not necessarily translate into government policy, critics cite the former U.S. President Donald Trump and the support enjoyed by Israel amongst powerful religious figures, as well as fringe elements in the U.S. society, to argue that the most extreme and rejectionist views about the apartheid have become normalized in U.S. politics. In further signs that support for Israel has morphed into an extremist position in the U.S., the Texas Republican Party has approved a platform that will make it illegal to create a Palestinian state in territories controlled by Israel. The platform, approved by 5,100 delegations in Houston, supports the prohibition of a Palestinian state within the so-called historical borders of Israel, as they claim it would jeopardize Israel's security. This platform, in essence, only lays the groundwork for further Israeli aggression and discrimination against Palestinians. Currently, as many as 12 million people reside in historic Palestine, but full rights are granted by the regime to Jews only, leaving the remaining 6 million non-Jews prone to various forms of racial discrimination depending on their place of residence. But does this type of platform represent the thinking of the U.S. as a whole when it comes to Palestinians, that they shouldn't have a right to their own land?
The United States has a long tradition of denying people their land rights and their homeland. We've done it to 500 nations in North America. So this is not at all surprising that they would say that the Palestinians should be denied their homeland. At the same time, the Zionists are immensely powerful and have powerful friends in the United States. So, particularly in the power structure and the political structure.
All this poses some serious question about the future of Palestinians in light of the U.S. and Israeli plots amid what seems to be international silence over the matter.
NATO leaders have held a meeting in the Spanish capital Madrid to discuss the expansion of the military alliance. NATO has formally invited Sweden and Finland to join the US-led military alliance. This is a historic expansion of the 30-member bloc. The military bloc, in a collective decision, approved the applications of Sweden and Finland a day after Turkey dropped its objections to the move. The decision will now be referred to the parliaments and legislators of the NATO member states for final ratification. The process is likely to move swiftly as the US-led military alliance seeks to build a bigger front against Russian President Vladimir Putin. Finland and Sweden applied to join NATO after Russia launched a special military operation in its neighbor Ukraine in February. NATO has officially declared Russia the most significant and direct threat to the security of its members. That marks a radical strategic shift spurred by the Russian military offensive against Ukraine.
It's the first time this new vision of Russia and its role in Europe is reflected in the strategic document of the Atlantic Alliance. Until recently, until this summit, NATO operated within the framework of the old strategy that was adopted back in 2010 at the Lisbon summit. And this strategy described Russia as a strategic partner of the NATO alliance. So we have a very decisive, a very radical shift in the approach.
And for the first time in its history, NATO has listed China as one of its strategic priorities, claiming that Beijing's ambitions challenge the Western bloc's interests, security, and values. NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says China is not a threat, but the alliance needs to be clear-eyed about the challenges it represents.
This shift will definitely color many new initiatives and steps taken by NATO, including its defense posture, its deployment patterns, including its rhetoric. So it is a kind of very important formal step which nails down the new normal and which will have a significant impact of what NATO is likely to plan in years to come.
Both Russia and China have reacted angrily to the accusations and threats directed against them by the NATO. Beijing has slammed NATO's warning as completely futile. In their recent gathering, NATO leaders said Beijing's ambitions, policies, and close ties to Russia pose a challenge to the interests and security of the military alliance. China has accused the alliance of, quote, maliciously attacking and smearing the country. Its mission to the European Union said NATO claims that other countries pose challenges, but it is NATO that is creating problems around the world. The confrontational rhetoric comes as the U.S. is stepping up efforts to increase its military presence in Europe.
Apparently, the assumption is that with more Western weapons coming to Ukraine, with more military assistance reaching Kyiv, with more exhaustion on the Russian side, the course of the military conflict might shift in Ukraine's favor, and that with time, Ukraine's negotiating positions might get stronger.
U.S. President Joe Biden pledged more American troops, warplanes, and warships for Europe. The U.S. has pledged over $5 billion in U.S. aid, yet Ukraine is losing the war. It is now believed the U.S. and Western allies are deliberately protracting the war to station more weapons and troops across Europe and militarize the public discourse.
Since the start of the war in Ukraine back in February, the prices of commodities have risen up sharply. But the rising prices of grain raise concerns about possible famine in different parts of the world. Russia and Ukraine together export nearly a third of the world's wheat and barley, more than 70% of its sunflower oil, and are prominent suppliers of corn. Russia is also the top global fertilizer producer. Russia has been accused of disruption in the transport of grain harvest in Ukraine. UN projections show that up to 181 million people in 41 countries could face a food crisis or even an outright famine. UK's Foreign Secretary Liz Truss has accused Moscow of using grain as a weapon.
Food should never be used as a weapon of war, but that's what we're seeing in Ukraine, with Putin's forces blocking the ports and stopping grain being exported around the world.
However, a look at history and UK's global imperialism reveals that London has often resorted to blockades to further its colonial ambitions. Starvation was a conscious resource for Britain's colonial projects. The starvation approach was used against countries like Ireland, Iran, India, Malaysia, and Nigeria. Meanwhile, blockades and sanctions has been used against a whole host of countries like Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe, to name a few, which all point to how the UK has used food as a weapon of war.
The UK throne symbolizes all forms of evil and genocide that we can imagine in human history. And England, and the Crown in particular, are the representatives of that. For centuries, they have extracted their wealth from oppressed peoples around the world, have shored up their pockets, have used financial schemes to colonize and oppress peoples around the world, to divide and conquer oppressed peoples in order to gain wealth.
The famine of 1845 to 1852 in Ireland was a man-made instrument of war and conquest. Over 1 million Irish people died of starvation. 1.5 million more left Ireland, many on coffin ships. Before the genocide, the population of Ireland stood at over 8 million. 150 years later, and the population has never reached that figure. Mass starvation was a regular feature of life in India under British rule. The last famine that was inflicted on India was in 1943, when over 4 million people died in Bengal. The British Army took millions of tons of rice from starving people. Even when other nations tried to send aid to the people of Bengal, Winston Churchill refused the offers. Britain's imperial project in India, its aim and methods was not to prevent famines, but to engineer them. During the so-called Malayan Emergency of 1948 to 1960, the British introduced a food denial program called Operation Starvation. Its aim was to starve out those who were resisting Britain's looting of the country. When Iran was occupied by British and Russian forces during World War I and II, countless Iranians died because they were denied food by the occupying imperial forces.
It has been involved with certain genocides and, of course, the first war in Iran and so forth, to kill, thousands of lives lost of Iranians. If we look back in history, this has not been, it has not only happened once, it has happened many times.
Iran declared itself neutral in both wars, but millions of Iranians lost their lives due to widespread famine and disease. In the late 1960s, the British armed and supplied Nigeria with mercenaries during the Biafran War in the name of protecting corporate oil. When it looked like Nigeria got the upper hand, Britain increased the supply of arms and ammunition. Britain supported a blockade against them, which resulted in countless people starving to death. The UK's imperial history shows that the regime in London tends not to care about the plight of people facing famine and hunger, and London's comments about using grain as weapon are a ploy to conceal its dark history.
To try to provide a different narrative against what is produced by the mainstream media is not an easy job. That's what Press TV has been trying to do all along. The coverage of issues like the Israeli regime's daily atrocities in the occupied Palestine, US war crimes in countries like Iraq and Afghanistan, and the US-backed Saudi war in Yemen, and the very fact that the hypocrisy on the part of the so-called mainstream media has brought Press TV on the wrong side of many people.
I think Press TV had a huge amount of success, certainly in the early years. Of course, they've faced a lot of pushback. Of course, the Zio Western media controls satellites. It controls a lot of the media output. So in more recent years, of course, there's been a tactic campaign, a concerted campaign, trying to stop Press TV being able to get as far as it could. YouTube have been involved. Many of the SAT channels, which are owned by Murdoch over here in the West, also turned on them. But nonetheless, there is a real substantial audience of Press TV which is picking up those lives and then sharing it across social media.
Press TV has faced hardships and bans since the very first days of its launch. Perhaps the most notable of such bans was in June 2021 when the channel's web domain was seized by the United States. In fact, by shutting down Press TV, the US decided for 1.4 billion English-speaking people on the planet that they can no longer watch and listen to news that goes against the US narrative. But why is it that a platform like Press TV faces so many restrictions? A recent poll by the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism paints a grim picture for the mainstream media. Not only they are losing their viewership, but their viewers also trust them less.
Trust in news is also declining and is lowest in the United States. On average, 42% of people said they trust most news most of the time.
Such news is not good news for the mainstream media, of course. People tend to turn to other sources of information that offer a different narrative, such as Press TV.
So the reality is that the Western media has played an absolutely diabolical role in terms of its kind of balanced reporting on West Asia as a whole. So not only Palestine, but Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Iran, that whole region, Western media has essentially been part of the terrorism that has been wrought on the entire region by Western imperialist military forces. The media in the West has really ridden shotgun and supplemented the psychological operations aspect of whatever they wanted to do in that region. What they want to do is obviously to subjugate the Yemenis, subjugate the Iraqis, subjugate everybody in that region to continue to maintain their hold on energy resources and various other geopolitical interests.
To get a glimpse of just how different Press TV is from other mainstream media, one can look at an open letter signed by more than 2,000 Canadian journalists last year about how biased their media is towards Israel.
Anyone who has worked in a Canadian newsroom has encountered the reluctance or resistance in covering Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. Canadian style guides still ban the use of the word Palestine in their coverage.
After publishing the letter, some journalists even published another letter saying they fear retaliation over publicly discussing such matters. In a world where mainstream media even censors their own journalists for using the word Palestine, it is no wonder that a platform like Press TV has faced so many hurdles and bans.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The
the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام عرفت الله سبحانه بفسخ العزائم وحل العقود ونقض الهمم.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, I came to know Allah the Glorified through the breaking of determinations, change of intentions, and losing of courage.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam's persona, and truly it is a universal persona because it transcends both time and place and national borders and ethnicities. The teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam, because they are from the source of the Holy Prophet, who in turn is from the source of the Almighty Allah, the teachings of these individuals become not only divine, but they also become timeless. We find that Imam Ali alayhi salam's life is beautifully intertwined with knowledge and wisdom, true knowledge and true wisdom. We find that Imam Ali alayhi salam says very beautifully that with knowledge a human being can acquire obedience during their life and a good name after their death. Knowledge is the ruler, while wealth is the one ruled upon. And dear friends, you know, we find that this is really true. When one increases in knowledge, when one increases in what is said in Arabic as ma'arifa, when one has this knowledge of life and death, of Allah and His attributes, this knowledge of the Ahlul Bayt, knowledge of the traditions, and one acts upon it, really one becomes obedient to the Almighty Allah in their life. Without knowledge, this obedience will not come about. And if obedience does come about, without knowledge. It is an obedience of a parrot, for example, which just follows but does not know why it is following. And so knowledge is that thing which helps us to know and voluntarily come into the obedience and the servitude of the Almighty Allah. And of course, with knowledge comes a good name after our death, for people will remember us as a person who had knowledge, a person who was intelligent, a person who was wise, even though our intention is not to have a good name for us after our death. But Imam Ali alayhi salam is telling us that knowledge is so valuable that even after we die, it will continue to be a benefit to every single one of us. A very profound and beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم إن قلوب المخبتين إليك والها وسبل الراغبين
O Allah, verily the hearts of those who surrender to Thee are full of passionate love. The path of those who long for Thee is the straight, true road. The instructions given by those who lead on Thee are distinct and precise. The minds of those who are aware of Thy reality are filled with awe and reverence. The call of those who invite unto Thee is loud and clear, and the doors of approval are kept open for them. Whoso submits his supplication to Thee receives a favorable answer. Whoso turns repentant unto Thee gets acceptance and amnesty. Whoso bursts into tears in fear of Thy punishment obtains mercy. Whoso seeks redress from Thee finds the required assistance at his disposal. Whoso asks for Thy help procures the aid as a gift. Thy promise made with Thy servants is fulfilled. Whoso asks for pardon of his errors finds them reduced to nothing. Whoso does everything for Thy sake discovers that each and every deed has been preserved. The means of livelihood available to the created being come from Thee like a rainfall, and in addition, many recurring favors and bounties reach them in regular succession. The sin of those who ask for forgiveness are overlooked. The wants and needs of all that which has been created by Thee are properly satisfied. Those who put forward genuine demands get more than they ask for, one after the other, again and again. For the hungry, wholesome food is arranged. For the thirsty, clean water is available in abundance.
تبكي عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي لها ولا راغي
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Whilst inside the shrine of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, the visitor is recommended to busy themselves and engage with the remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, whether it's through the recitation of the Quran or through a number of important supplications, invocations, and ziyaras that indeed establish this connection to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala through the remembrance of the Ahlul Bayt. Here, for example, we are in the sahan, or the courtyard, so to speak, of Sayyida Fatima within the shrine of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. And a visitor here is recommended to recite a number of supplications and ziyaras. One could recite Dua al-Sabah, the supplication for the morning from Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, or Ziyarat Ashura, Ziyarat Warith, Ziyarat al-Jami' al-Kabira, Hadith al-Kisa, Dua Kumail ibn Ziyad, Dua al-Nudba, Dua al-Samat, Dua al-Tawassul, the Munajat of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. This and many other supplications are highly recommended. But of course, one of the most crucial is one that is referred to as Ziyarat Aminullah. Now, this ziyara is not only specific for the shrine of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, but for every one of the ma'sumeen, whether it's in Madinatul Munawwara, whether it is in Najaf, Karbala, Kadhimain, Mashhad, or in Samarra. We are recommended to recite Ziyarat Aminullah, which is an authentic ziyara established and one that is from the fourth holy Imam, Imam Zain al-Abidin al-Sajjad, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi. Now this ziyara is key because it's made up of two segments. The first is the greeting of the Imam alayhi salam. The second is a supplication to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, when we recite this ziyara and any others, it is crucial that we recite it in Arabic, but also to try and figure out and ascertain its meaning in our own languages too. For example, if it is English or any other language, let's read the translation and reflect on the words. As-salamu alayka ya amin Allahi fi ardih. Peace and blessings be upon you, O the one who is entrusted by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and his vicegerent on his earth. Ashhadu annaka jahadta fillahi haqqa jihadih. I bear witness that you struggled in the path of Allah in the best possible way. وَعَمِلْتَ بِكِتَابِهِ. And you worked to establish the teachings of Allah through the Holy Quran. وَاتَّبَعْتَ سُنَنَ نَبِيِّهِ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَآلِهِ. And you followed the teachings and the path of his Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him and his holy progeny. حَتَّى دَعَاكَ اللَّهُ إِلَىٰ جِوَارِهِ فَقَبَضَكَ إِلَيْهِ بِاخْتِيَارِهِ. Until Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala raised you towards him and made you in his proximity.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Welcome to another episode of Palestine Declassified, where we examine the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. We'll be talking to the founders of Palestine Action this week, a group that successfully chased Israel's largest arms company from its London headquarters, and forced it to sell its subsidiary for anti-technologies in Oldham. I'll be speaking to experts to